Wouldn't you love to get paid for doing what you love to do? If you're ready to move on to what's next, join us for Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson. Our uplifting live talk show on Saturday mornings from 10 to noon will have you circling back, not running in circles, to pull your experience forward in new ways. Advance your career, plus help others with theirs. Join us Saturdays, 10 to noon, right here on 104.1 The Truth, for pragmatic advice and unconventional wisdom. Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson, where your path is created by walking on it. Welcome to our second hour here on Circles of Change. Thanks for sticking with us or joining us anew. I'm Zara Larson. And, you know, many times my friends or colleagues or people listen and ask me, where do I find my guests? And, you know, nobody's safe sitting next to me on an airplane. And my latest venue, of course, I do listen to other radio stations and say, oh, they'd make a good guest. Well, lo and behold, I was listening to NPR. And I knew Teresa Christie, and here she was on Kai Ryssdal's show. So I said, she's got to come on mine. So, Teresa, welcome to the show. How are you this morning?
Thank you, Zara. I'm doing well, and it's a delight to be talking to you again.
It's really fun. Let me explain our association. In fact, Teresa Munkel Christie is a graduate of Wellesley College with a Bachelor of Arts and Babson College with an MBA, as well as Central Connecticut University with a Master's of Arts. She joined Otis Elevator Company in 1986 that I had the pleasure of being a leader at for several years, and she's currently an Otis Fellow with expertise in elevatoring and dispatching, and we'll learn about what that's all about. Teresa is a named inventor on numerous elevator patents and enjoys using mathematics, statistics, and computer simulation to solve technical problems related to traffic flow in large buildings. She also enjoys representing Otis around the world by collaborating with elevator consultants, building owners, architects, and other key stakeholders in high-rise building projects to design these vertical transportation configurations that really best serve each building's form and function. I'd also say she's a skilled ethnographer, so she knows how to watch people's behaviors in the midst of this, which is a little bit scary as far as I'm concerned, Teresa. So you know the math behind it as well as the social context.
Yeah, and it's fun to combine the two of them.
I bet it is.
Put two of my interests together.
Sure, absolutely. Well, Teresa, the opportunity to do the kind of work that you do, not just enjoying, as I think I read one of the articles that subsequently has been published about you, that you actually get played for creating computer games that really are controlling real-world experiences, don't you?
Yes. We call them computer simulation programs.
Mm-hmm.
And in my case, what we do is we write the software that actually mimics what's happening as far as the elevators are concerned in a real building. And we're showing them on the screen, so we have animation. And then we take the controller software, that's real controller software from Otis Elevators, and we recompile it so that it will run in a faster mode on a PC so that we can run through, for example, an hour's worth of what's happening in a building in a matter of seconds. We can then get the results, or we can run it much more slowly so that we can watch exactly what's happening, where each person's going, and which elevator is coming to pick them up. So what I get to do is help write the software for those simulations. But then, if you were to come into my office on a typical day, you might see me staring at the screen, watching elevators move, and occasionally stopping it and making a tweak, all with the goal of seeing if I can get better performance at the end of, say, an hour's run or a 2 hours run. And this is very analogous to playing a video game, mm-hmm. where you're trying to get a higher score with different constraints. Maybe I'm not rescuing a princess, but maybe I'm letting someone wait a few seconds less for an elevator, and that's a win for me. So it's a fun job.
Well, it is, and I think people don't understand that, and the whip and smart technology that's been involved, and now we're talking, of course, since I was at Otis, it was in the mid-90s, that, you know, the application of chaos theory and self-learning elevators in these high-rise that based on the traffic flow, and even, I recall, oh my goodness, something went haywire and we realized that they had moved the cafeteria from floor number 4 to floor number 18 in a high rise, didn't tell us in the elevatoring world, and we had all sorts of traffic jams going on, and the elevators on their own started alerting and almost relearning what kind of sequence it should do to maximize the traffic patterns for people.
Yes. What we try to do in high-rise buildings is to use as few elevators as will serve the population well. And the reason that we want to do that is because building owners like to rent their buildings, and they want to get money for the rental space. The elevator space is not rentable. So if we use more elevators and use up more space, the owner has less income coming in, less rentable space. So all of the elevator companies want to provide as good service as they can with the smallest amount of real estate in the building being used up. That being said, we come up with some very complicated and technologically advanced algorithms, software that's running behind the scenes, that's trying to figure out the best way to utilize the elevators so that we can maximize efficiency, and this way we can reduce the number of elevators. And what we do to do that is learn traffic patterns in the building so that, for example, the situation that you described, where we had a cafeteria on one floor, our elevators had gotten used to the fact that that's where they had to be at a certain time of day so that they could move people most efficiently. And not only that, but so that they could kind of guess if they're looking at an up-hall call button or a down-hall call button in the hallway, they could guess where the person waiting in the hall wanted to go. They didn't know for sure, but they could kind of guess, oh, it's this time of day, it's the cafeteria. Well, when they suddenly moved the cafeteria, that caused us an issue. But, of course, we do put in software that's going to self-adjust so that it may take a few minutes or a few days, depending on the building and the type of software that's in there, to actually come to grips with this.
Most people also don't know to appreciate, of course, that Otis Elevator is a very global company from its very inception with Elijah Graves Otis, and that, of course, today, I think, at least I recall my statistics, you were operating or had offices in all but four countries around the world.
Yes,
so part of your isn't that in your elevatoring challenge, though, is that there's a social context around elevators, because I know in some Asian countries, people line up right before they go in the elevator, where you certainly wouldn't see that in Manhattan.
Yes, we have a lot of different cultural expectations for elevators, and in, especially in Japan, people want to line up, and they do so and have nice orderly lobbies, so they want to know which elevator is going to come and get them in advance so that they can kind of walk over and stand in front of that elevator, and they stand back so that the people in the elevator can come out, and then they nice and orderly get in. In some other cities in the world, like a lot of the U.S., big U.S. cities, people are all very anxious to get on as fast as possible, and they crowd around and they kind of mill around the lobby, and it's just a different experience. And our software is actually tuned to that kind of thing as to whether it's going to load people really quickly or whether it's going to have to wait for someone to show up a little bit longer, in addition to how many people we can fit in. Some countries tend to have a smaller average weight or average physical size, so we can get more people into the same size elevator, and we take that into account.
Which, of course, is something, regretfully, hello, U.S. healthcare, that you're also really mindful of as you're continuing design work. Well, I remember also the whole styling aspect. Of course, I moved from the automotive industry, as you know, Teresa, over to elevatoring, and there's some design styling elements into it, such as, lo and behold, the introduction of mirrored outside doors to deal with the ego that if I can sit here and prep and prep my hairdo a little bit before I get on the elevator, I'm not necessarily as mindful of having to wait those additional 2 or 3 seconds because of something else happening in that whole bay of elevators.
That's right. That's right. And we in the industry laugh about that one, that sometimes if someone's complaining about the service and they say, gee, you know, people are waiting too long, what, of course, we would first do is try to analyze the situation and see if there's something that we can technically do to resolve that situation. Is it because something changed in the building that was different, that we didn't take into account? But if we get into a situation, and we often do in older buildings, where there's only so many elevators and maybe more and more people have come to work in that building, we would sometimes tend to laugh and tell the building owner or the building manager, why don't you put some mirrors in your lobby? People will like looking at themselves, and they won't think about the fact that they're waiting for the elevator. And mirrored doors are a great way to do that, too.
But then, of course, also this whole idea then at some point putting entertainment features inside the elevator, but then you got the challenge of getting people the heck out of there in a safe way so that new people can come in.
Right, and it's something that not many people think about. Not many people do what I do all day long, which is to think about the best way to get traffic flow and elevators moving together. So a lot of people are saying, you know, it's so boring being in an elevator, and then sometimes you stop, and other people get on and off, and you're just standing there waiting for your stop. Why don't we put TV in there or video or something interesting? And it sounds good, but my fear, from my point of view, is always, yes, and then just when the really exciting part of the video comes, it's time to get off, and you don't want to, and you delay getting off, which means I can't use that elevator to pick up somebody else or move somebody else. So my perspective is slightly different than the passenger riding the elevator.
Yeah, but you can keep your eye on it. Well, and again, for our listeners, we're speaking with Teresa Christie. She's an Otis Technical Fellow involved with elevatoring and dispatching. Dispatching meaning the idea of which one goes when, right, Teresa?
Yes. Yeah, it's a very simple thing to explain. It's just difficult to do behind the scenes. Is when you're faced with a number of elevators, say there are six elevators that might possibly come to get you when you're looking for service, which one is the elevator dispatcher, which is a piece of software behind the scenes, going to send to get you? Sounds pretty simple. It just turns out that there's millions of combinations, and which one is going to provide the best overall service to that building? That's the challenge we deal with, and it's quite technically challenging, mathematically complicated, and I really enjoy it. It's like a big game.
Well, it's a big game, and I'll tell you something. The story off to the side, of course, is I joined Otis from the automotive industry, and Teresa and her colleagues, I know behind the scenes, took great delight in doing management reviews for me because I had to keep slowing them down and saying, "No, wait a minute, can you explain this in 0 to 60 in how many seconds?" That, and they would, you know, I will readily admit it, dumb it down in little boxes and squares so I could kind of catch up. And then I learned very quickly that, nope, I'm delegating this one. So long as I keep this group happy, they're getting extra perks. They're going to keep, you know, doing the techno magic. Or as we know, when I left Otis, in fact, I gave one of my magic wands to Teresa, which she surprisingly told me you still have in your drawer. I love it.
I still have, and I just think it's a great way to think about things. And I'll just tell your audience, if I can, Zara, how this came about.
Sure?
I was looking at a building in New York, and they were having some issues with the elevators. And I was explaining to Zara that I needed a magic wand in order to satisfy this set of customers because they just, you know, wanted the impossible. And to my surprise, she had several glitter sticks in her drawer, and she pulled one out, and she said, "Here you go." I have used that magic wand in presentations to emphasize to people that this is the kind of thing that we have to do. You know,
yep,
we have to wave our wand and make everything better, and I definitely still have it.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Well, Teresa, I know one thing you wanted to share with our audience, of course, again, your technical grounding and your loving simulation and working in all the codes and so on, and also, obviously, the opportunity to travel all around the world and interacting with wonderful stakeholders as well as observing people, but that at one point you thought your career wanted to take you into managing, and I wanted you to share the ahas and ohos that you have walked away from of having that step.
Okay, and this is something that I'm often asked to tell our young engineers coming in, because my story is that perhaps because I was an oldest child, I always thought I would be good at being in charge and telling people what to do and kind of organizing something. So sort of at a young age, I decided that I would probably be management material, and I worked towards that goal. I went to school at night and got an MBA. I often looked for opportunities to take charge of a group or to look for, well, what promotion is going to get me to the next group lead position.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I found as I was doing that that was okay, but I wasn't getting to work on the real problems as much. And I somehow felt the stress of, I don't really like telling somebody else, go solve this problem. I want to solve it myself.
Yeah,
and then I would be working like within Microsoft Project or something like that, trying to fit people into boxes as to how many hours they could work on a particular project and what the cost was going to be associated with that and when were we going to finish. And I found that that wasn't the kind of problem that I really enjoyed. But I did this for a couple years trying to figure it out. And then I took a statistics class because there was one particular problem on my desk at the time that I wanted to solve. And when I went for that class, I found myself just really enjoying the domain. And this makes a lot of people laugh because they think statistics, how could you possibly enjoy it? But I do. And that was when I sort of realized that my efforts to go into management weren't really what was making me happy. And it really crystallized when my husband commented one time, you know, you take these classes and you come home all excited, you talk about it, you do your homework for hours and you don't complain.
Mm-hmm.
When you were taking your MBA studies, you were, you know, frequently frustrated, didn't want to go back to the books. And I really started to realize that for me, management wasn't the right route. And I switched gears. I thought about teaching for a little while, but realized that I still enjoyed solving the problems myself. And I do enjoy teaching, but in the Otis Fellow path, which was being introduced at the time, it was an opportunity to be sort of an individual contributor, a technical expert in a certain area, with the idea that I would also train some of our other engineers and some of our sales force, our technical sales force. So I do get a little bit of the best of both worlds. I get to do some teaching. I get to do some problem solving on my own, sitting at my desk. And I don't really manage schedules very often. And so for me, it really works out well. And I was really glad that I was able to sort of switch gears and move in a different direction.
Well, and I think for, and you know, that there's, and I bet you that your having taken that 2-year departure over to management, though, has served you well on the flip side of it, because now you might have a little bit more empathy for the person that's got to do those Microsoft charts. Plus, you know the value, really, of what they're going to offer you on that flip side. Well, we talk about that constantly here on Circles of Change, this idea of how do we find our sweet spot? And some of us might know just by having watched ourselves through over the years, but other times it takes that going out and experimenting, doesn't it, Teresa?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And recently I had a young woman that was working with me, and she was debating whether she should take a supervisory class, which was sort of a 2-day training class. And she thought, well, I'm not sure I want to be a supervisor. I might want to stay technical. And I told her that this class would be a good thing for her to take no matter what she decided, because even if she chose not to go the supervisory route, now she knows what her supervisors are up against.
Sure, exactly.
Great thing. It's really good to know both sides of the story as much as you can, because we often have this image that our leaders or our management can do whatever they want and make whatever decisions they want, and somehow they're being stubborn and not making the decision we want. Well, but when you see the other side of it, you realize the constraints that they're dealing with. And it makes for a much better working relationship, better conversations and sharing when you sort of see both sides, even if you're not planning to make a career out of it.
Isn't that true? Well, Teresa, you mentioned, of course, that you thought about teaching at one time, and here you find yourself indeed doing some teaching. And I know in prep for this segment, you and I talked about the fact that this 15 minutes of fame, which I think is going to be a lot longer for you with Otis tapping on you, and you know you're getting additional exposure, has had some interesting opportunities finding you, the high school teacher, right? Can share with our audience something that's cooking there.
Yeah, this was really interesting. There was an article about me in the Wall Street Journal, which is just something that one of the Wall Street reporters thought it would be interesting to learn more about elevators. And they contacted Otis, and Otis asked me to speak with this woman. And it turned into an article that was very well received. And to my surprise, people started contacting me just from having seen the article and asking me some questions. Mm-hmm. And a number of those people were high school teachers who said something like, I'm a math teacher or I'm a computer science teacher, and I really would like to motivate my students with some real-world examples so that they realize what kinds of things can happen as a result of the things they're learning. So they asked me to perhaps come and speak with their class. But one situation in particular turned into, would I work with the teacher to develop a set of problems that people could solve or students could solve in the high school environment that were representative of the real problems that we were working on, but that also used the particular math skills that they were learning. And I just thought this was a really interesting opportunity and challenge, and I'm looking forward to working with this individual, and we're going to be starting that in February.
Yeah, wonderful. We're speaking with Teresa Christie. She's an Otis Technical Fellow at the Otis Elevator Company. You can go to www.otis.com. And I would actually suggest you might want to go dig through your desk, because I think there's probably some sample problems you actually developed to explain dispatching to me as the executive at the time that you can use it. But, you know, in general, Teresa, this idea that we never know if we're open to it, which path or where our careers are going to take us. But that simple phone call from the teacher said, well, would you think about it? And for all you know, you're going to start laying the pipe for, who knows, an encore career for you. Not that you're going to leave Otis, but something that in tangential you can play to that other sweet place that you've got about technology. And heaven only knows, nationwide in particular, we need to inspire more young people to approach the science, technology, engineering side of the world, don't we?
Absolutely. I really hope that in this next generation we can get a whole new group of people thinking of the challenges. I work with the Connecticut Science Fair and help provide some judging for the young students from both 7th and 8th grade schools and then high schools, and they come and they present their projects to us. And I can tell you there are a number of wonderful creative students out there, and I just wish we could have even more. I wish we could get people as excited as some of the students I see are about trying something new, finding the answer to a new question. It's the what if. What if I tried this? Or how does this really work? And it's something that I'm not sure we promote to be as exciting as it really can be. Sometimes we have this whole image of it as being dull or dry or only mm-hmm. geeks do that. And you find out that a lot of very interesting people really do this kind of thing.
Absolutely.
If you're familiar with Neil deGrasse Tyson, but when he speaks, it turns the whole field into magic.
Yeah, isn't that true? Well, I think the other piece of it, of course, there are some really good perks to your job. I mean, in my day, it would be I could get any company car or competitive car to drive, and in your case, you can ride a lot of fun elevators, not necessarily just inside the car. You're sometimes on top of the car, aren't you?
Yes, and this is something I don't do often because usually it's our field mechanics or our service mechanics that are doing this, but it's actually necessary on occasion for people to ride on the top of the elevator car to check what's happening in the hoistway. And I had the experience to join an Otis mechanic years ago in New York City to ride the top of the car, and it was quite an adventure. I was a little quite nervous before I got on, but I really wanted to do it. It's actually quite safe if you're an Otis mechanic and follow all the rules. It is not safe at all for a college student to climb on top of a car and do something called surfing. It's very dangerous, and there have been a number of people killed that way. But when you're doing it as part of the safe environment that Otis promotes, it's really exciting, and you get to see the elevator from a whole new point of view. And you get to see buildings from a whole new point of view, too. You get to see what's behind making these buildings function.
Yeah, indeed, which, again, for anyone technically inclined, it's something we all take for granted. We're not even mindful or conscious of it. So tell me, what's on the drawing board, if you're allowed to say, of some new exciting new concept you're working on in dispatching an elevator in Teresa?
Okay, well, what I'd like to tell you about, Sarah, is something called destination dispatching. It's new in one sense. It's not brand new. It's out there, but it's very new in that only a few high-end buildings are currently using this. I suspect over time it will be more and more. But it's different from the traditional up-down buttons that most people who ride elevators are used to. You know, you go to the hallway, you press up or down. Now, instead, you're going to be faced with a keypad or a touch screen where you actually input the number of the floor you want to go to. So, for example, if I want to go to floor 7, I press 7, and there's a little screen. If it's a keypad or if it's a touchpad, it responds and tells you, please wait for car A, and all the cars are labeled. If somebody else then goes and presses a different floor, it may tell them to wait for car C, for example. So it's a different interface than we've got now, but it allows us to be more efficient, and it also means that once you get into the elevator, you don't have to press that panel anymore. You don't have to sort of fight through a little bit of a crowd or, you know, say to someone else, please would you press 7.
Hitting the door close button, which we're all convinced really don't work. Well, actually, I think what you're going to really do is you're setting us up for being able to deal with that old thing that most our kids always ask us is, when are we going to be there? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? So it's also the management of expectations. Well, Teresa Christie, congratulations for your ongoing contributions to Otis Elevator, as well as I'm so pleased and tickled pink to know you're still waving that magic wand. So keep at it, my friend.
Thank you, Zara.
A real pleasure.
Change is chaotic. That is, unless you embrace it, going places you hadn't dreamed were possible. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, is a leadership consulting, executive coaching, and career transition firm. We help individuals make the most of their current employment situation or to step forward confidently into a career transition. Contact us at thelarsongroup.com or toll-free 1-877-544-2580. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, helping others unleash potential through transformational change. 1-877-544-2580.